believe it, but I've seen it done. To make a longer story, and we're still going on with the testing, we sacrificed 8 of our celluloid cylinders, 4 blue amberols, 2 indestructible, and 2 everlasting, to make sure that in fact they were a cellulose nitrate. They are. We're presently doing an aging test on them to try to determine what their ignition point is. We have not yet got that answered, and we are presently continuing with it to try to find out where it is. It appears at the moment that it's between 160 and 175 degrees Fahrenheit. The library safety officer, a man who I'm sure Wynn Mathias has had occasion to meet, and if not, you're lucky, Wynn, is usually extremely conservative, and his conservatism is, I think, to our advantage at this point. After reviewing the whole problem, discussing it, going into it in some detail, he expressed in writing the opinion that there was no serious hazard problem, and we did not have to begin, what I feared would be the case, the process of going through our entire cylinder collection, which is some 35,000 items or so, and segregating out our celluloid materials. We're in the process of doing it anyway, but at least we didn't have to stop everything and do it nonstop. We estimated at the time it would take between 1,000 and 1,200 hours to really do it because of the wear and how they're stored. In conclusion with it, I simply want to make you aware, if you're not aware, that celluloid cylinders are made of nitrate cellulose, and to please bear it in mind when you're handling them, when you're storing them. It's urgently recommended that they not be stored in particularly hot areas. Don't leave them sitting in your car, or if in fact they are deteriorated or having problems, you may not have a car when you get back. The second thing I'll share, and this is much briefer. Surely. No, we have not. Yes, it is something we're definitely doing. The box that's now being passed around was this past year we noticed, as I'm sure everybody does who stores material in pasteboard boxes, that they were beginning to get beat up and crumbled and were having problems. The Library of Congress, being the conservative place that it is, when I sent in an order to buy replacement boxes for our 10.5-inch tapes, said you've got to send us samples of the boxes you want to buy. I sent it in. They tested it and said there's no way in the world you're going to use our money to buy those things. They are archival quality. Acid level is at LC is defined, I believe, at 7.5 pH or better, with various buffers and marginal error, margins for error, etc. The best one, and these were the standard 10-inch boxes that are 10.5-inch boxes, which most of you who've ever been to LC have seen. The best one of those was 5.2. So we began working, trying to figure out what we could do. And since we were going to have to go through the process of reboxing about 150,000 tapes sometime, and hopefully in my lifetime, because the preservation office says that we can't keep what we've got, we decided to try to really design what we would like to have ideally. The two boxes that are being passed around are the first two items off the assembly line of that box. They're made out of polypropylene. They're inert. They use an antimony oxide as a fire retardant. There are a number of other aspects about it, and if time allows later, I'll be happy to discuss it with you. They are actually cost less than the pasteboard boxes which we've been buying and using. They are embossed, as you can see, with the Library of Congress's seal in the front. depends on the quantity as everything else. If you're buying in quantity of I think 5,000 or more, my understanding is they're around $2 a piece. Now the price goes up considerably if you want special embossing or special colors, etc. But with the box, that box as it stands now is about $2. Those are the first two off the assembly line. In fact, I had not seen them until I got here. Now, my program. The Library of Congress Optical Disc Project, a pilot program, has two broad goals: preservation and access. The program consists of two experimental projects: a print project devoted to text materials and a non-print project devoted to a wide variety of visual media and sound recordings. The discs in both projects are read by lasers. They suffer, as far as we can determine thus far, little if anywhere, and they should have a very long life. At least we're hoping that they do, and thus far it seems that they do. The print project involves a custom-designed digital disc system, and the images will be displayed on a special high-resolution screen with 300 by 150 lines per inch resolution. In the first round of work, the materials to be put on the digital discs include several periodicals and government reports, to be followed by a few legal materials, manuscripts, maps, and sheet music. Digital discs offer great promise for saving space. In our system, an 8x10 book page occupies an estimated 54,000 square millimeters of space. The same page occupies 150 square millimeters on 35 millimeter microfilm and 70 millimeters of space on microfiche. On the disc, the data is actually a string of bits and a spiral, but we estimate that they occupy the equivalent of three to six square millimeters, as opposed to 54,000 for the actual item. If you're dealing with quantities, as most of us are in many ways, that makes a hell of a difference. Digitized color would require a large amount of storage on the disc, and we do not presently plan to digitize color materials in color. We will, however, render illustrations as halftones with a special algorithm that is actually more efficient than the middle figures on this chart imply. We expect to get from 10 to 15,000 pages per disc. The library will make the digital discs on the premises, one at a time. The process uses a variable power laser both to write and to read the information. A jukebox machine, which will hold up to 100 discs each, can bring each disc up in a matter of seconds. I think we're presently averaging 2.5 seconds to get the disc up and onto a reader and the data in front of you. Thus, something on the order of 1 million pages of print could be at a researcher's beck and call within less than 5 seconds. To turn from the print to the non-print project, the library is creating 8 discs, 6 laser video discs, and 2 compact digital audio discs. Unlike the library's print project, which has developed a new type of disc, the non-print project employs the same type of discs as a variety of institutions and the entertainment industry. This type of discs is produced in batches instead of one at a time, a little like pressing a phonograph record. Thank you, Mr. Berliner. And the discs for our pilot project were produced by Sony Corporation. One of the most important features of the laser video disc is the ability to freeze frame. A single side can contain a half hour of motion picture footage, or motion footage. This equals, as we've heard before, 54,000 individual frames. A two-sided disc will obviously hold better than 100,000 frames. Although you lose the ability to freeze frame, the video disc can also be formatted to contain 1 hour of motion footage per side. 3 of the video discs contain still images from the library's divisions. Collections include the rarely seen color photographs made by the Depression era Farm Security Administration. The images were copied onto 35 millimeter motion picture film as part of the production process. This aids our preservation goals and will make it easier to retransfer materials when high-definition television becomes a reality and available. 3 other video discs contain motion images, films and television productions from the collections of the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division, the division of which I'm a part. The two digital audio discs present music from concerts in the library's Coolidge Auditorium series. The non-print discs' impact on preservation will vary. The still discs will reduce wear and tear on original items, an indirect preservation benefit. A special test disc will test for film color stability, and the teleproduction and audio discs will fully equal the quality of the original items. At least that's what we're finding so far. The matter is nearly reversed in the case of impact in its impact upon research. Here, the tiny number of motion picture, teleproduction, and audio samples present much useful testing material, but the large number of stills will offer us a great opportunity. The most sophisticated application is found in the Prints and Photographs reading room, where a computerized database has been linked, I think it's a PC, I'm not sure, has been linked to the images on the disk. This will be a standalone system, unlike the digital disk setup with its links to the library's mainframe system. The captions are scaled-down versions of catalog records, and a researcher will be able to search them in a manner analogous to a bibliographic search on the library's computerized card catalog. You might combine such things as date, place, and subject, and come up with things like plantation and labor, and find a caption like this one. Once found, the researcher can call up the picture and view it instantly. That's a relative term, of course. And you can also browse through the pictures and then call up the captions. You can browse, as with any other most pre-programmed discs, et cetera, you can browse, I think it's something like 3/4 of a second, or you can make it faster, you can make it slower, et cetera, if you just want to browse and find something that you're interested in. This is the plantation labor print that you might come up with, for example. It's worth noting that although the program involves mastering aspects of technology and cataloging, it also obliges us to wrestle with knotty questions of intellectual property and propriety, copyright. We're working with representatives of the publishing and library communities to answer questions about the circumstances under which we may transfer materials to disk, whether audio, moving image, text, or whatever, and the ways in which our patrons may then make use of that material. The project will be evaluated in several ways. We'll use computers to evaluate the life and stability of data on the digital discs. The video and audio discs are made of plastics laminated with other materials. Several batches will be tested in a variety of temperature and humidity environments to determine their stability and probable lifespan. We'll also test the metal masters used to make them. The operation of the program will be evaluated by a combination of questionnaires and interviews. At the end of the pilot program, the library will be able to intelligently, hopefully intelligently, plan the best ways to use optical discs in the future. The Optical Disc Project is now well into its third year at the Library of Congress. The scholarly use of compact audio disc materials is the responsibility of the division in which I'm located, the Motion Picture Broadcasting Recorded Sound Division. And it will be carried out through its established sections, which serve film, tape, and other disc materials as well as audio. The Lab Services section, which is headed by Bob Carneal, whom many of you know, performs the testing and familiarization with new materials and suggests the handling procedures to people like my section, which is curatorial, the section that Wynn is in, reference, processing, cataloging, etc. It's rare that such a commercial venture as Compact Audio Discs offers an archival institution a potential medium that is both excellent for reference purposes and seems to simultaneously satisfy requirements for its own preservation. We're still hoping that it bears that out. As part of the non-print optical disc experiment, the library provided to the contractor selections from two concerts performed in the Coolidge Auditorium in 1982-83. They were originally recorded on magnetic tape in both analog and digital form. One musical selection was transferred from analog master tape to compact audio disc, and the second was transferred from digital master to compact audio disc. These were chosen for the express purpose of comparing the finished compact disc to the original master tapes and to the opposing analog or digital master tapes, respectively. We pressed multiple copies for the purpose of physical testing of the item for use in our investigations. We recognized the opportunity to be presented by compact audio disc and the list of advantages that it presents. I'm sure you all know them, cueing easily, push-button selection, automatic repeating, storage compactness, the temperature stability of it, storage container supports the disc itself, and so forth, as well as the negatives. It's according to Consumers Reports, and by the way, the Consumers Reports, I believe, for this month carries a review of CD players. If you're not aware of it, and if you're in the market and looking, you might want to buy it. The medium's new. It means not too much experience has been known had with it. The transfers from analog tapes to digital masters have shortcomings, generally related to experience, it's felt. There are technical demands on the mastering process, lacking experience, and the limited repertoire. In September of 1984, the Compact Disc Trade Group, a trade organization of individuals concerned with CDs, presented to the library one copy of each disc thus far manufactured. This allowed us to take copies which we had already purchased and to be able to do some comparative aging and testing on them. The library's preservation testing office has not yet begun its systematic evaluation, but the lab services section under Bob Cornell has done some preliminary work. The first three slides give you a view of the front brochure and panel one of the two CDs the library has produced for testing. Slide 4 shows the commercial package that you're all used to by now. The first problem we were faced with in any collection out there is how to mark those bloody little things. Nothing sticks to them. The first thing we tried was finally getting a metal tag, which we use on equipment, and actual cement. Not stone ground cement, but an adhesive. We thought of that too. A metal tag is put onto the label side, since they're single-sided discs at this point. And the question is, what was the weight of that going to bear? The average disc that we found so far is 16.62 grams. And the marker weighed an additional 1.7 grams. Thus, a little over 10% of weight was added to the package. What was going to happen to it when you played it with this thing on it? The disc travels at an angular speed of approximately 500 RPM on the inside most diameters and decreases to 200 RPM on the outside, giving a constant linear speed of approximately 4 feet per second. Listening tests give no indication with this label on it that the label and the weight presents any added problem or any problem to the disc. Still, we want to use, to avoid the potential problems, we are trying to find a lighter label to affix to it so that we don't have the problems. So we don't wake up in 20 years and find out we've got them, or in 2 weeks or whatever. A second task has been to examine the ability of the disc to tolerate temperature and humidity controls. Until recently, the best and most cost-effective medium for archival preservation has been the LP disc. We all know what happens with that when you get it too hot. From the Pickett and Lemko, we learned that heat, dust, ultraviolet light, moisture, and handling were the enemies of vinyl, and for the long-time storage, measured in potential centuries, moisture and heat would lead to the formation of oxides of nitrogen on the surfaces, which would be self-catalyzing, leading eventually to disc destruction of the LP. In the short term, 25 years to 100 years, heat, dust, and handling were common enemies that might well destroy vinyl LPs before the formation of any oxides on the surface. To compare the LP and the CD, Bob Cornell used that well-established temperature and humidity chamber called the back rear window of your car. He took two LPs and four CDs, all brand new, and a thermometer. He put them on the back ledge of his car from May 1984 through September 1984. Cornell is nothing if not creative. All items were housed in their originally delivered packaging. They were all commercial discs with no pre-selection of what it would be. The temperature varied, as if anyone knows Washington, knows it full well, from 47 degrees Fahrenheit to 141 degrees Fahrenheit. The humidity followed Washington's traditional summer patterns, which was from high to very, very high. it was not measured, unfortunately. Slide 6 shows what happens to an LP. This was one of the two LPs. He personally, by the way, went out and bought these out of his own pocket to see what was going to happen. He wanted me to give him two out of the collection. I said, no way, and he went out and bought them. Slide 7 shows the CD in its original container, and the only thing that we could find visually wrong with it, and obviously visually there's a great deal wrong with this, we could find visually wrong with it was that the glue on the plastic containing it, where the white marker is, let's see if I can figure out how to work this thing, then I can't use it, right? Thanks. No, don't bother. The glue on the plastic container melted and bonded with the plastic, the cellophane melted and bonded with the plastic container. It was the only thing that we've been able to find that happened to it. The CD is still quite playable. It has not separated. The center support seen here suspends the CD from the center, giving clearance between the playing surface and the case that holds it. As you, I'm sure you've all seen these. It's a very good package design from preservation standpoint and holding. Even when the disc is pushed or canted on the center spindle intentionally, much less accidentally, the surfaces touch only at the brims, and the disc seems very well protected from inadvertent contact with its playing side. Articles written in various journals questioned the possibility of the discs delaminating between the aluminized information layer and the protective plastic outer covers. To see if he could make them delaminate, Carneal heated one of the CDs used in his automobile experiment, already have gone through 4 months of heat cycling, remember, to 150 degrees, kept it there for several days, and then cut it in half. You can see the sheer cracks on the stress from where he used a bandsaw to cut it in half. This is where he took razor blades, nails, fingernail files, anything he could find. I think he used a scalpel as well, and tried to do everything he could to make that sandwich delaminate. He said he could not. It did not delaminate. Instead, he would be able to break off small pieces of plastic, similar to what would happen with the polypropylene, I think. Oh, not polypropylene, anyway, with other plastics. Pardon me? I'll answer that in just a minute. You might be surprised. At least the machine tried. Bob's final concern with CDs revolved around the reflective properties on the disc and how much obliteration of the information layer would it take to make the playback impossible. Measuring the reflective properties will be left to the library's optical office and the preservation office. They have not yet given us any response to it. At this point, however, we decided to use self-adhesive labels to obliterate intentional measured portions of the playing surface and to test the operation of the error-correcting circuits of available players just to see what effect it might have on the sound. The total area obstructed here is approximately 0.57% of the entire playing surface. By using three different players to play back the same passage, we can accomplish both purposes. First, you'll hear the passage without obstruction as it should sound. The next three examples are from players 1, 2, and 3, which will remain anonymous for obvious reasons in a moment, playing the same passage with the obstructions shown on the slide. You'll notice that player 1 does a remarkable job of correction without ever seeing the disc information under the strip. Yeah. The white strip. At roughly 1 o'clock. Can you see it? Player 1 really plays it quite well. Player 2 is not quite as good, and player 3, well, you'll have to hear player 3 yourself. Do I have sound up, please? Not quite so. Down a little. Selection was not mine. player number one with the obstruction on it. I'm going to talk over it. I'm not going to play the rest of the examples. So I'll play these first four. This is player number two. You can hear the click starting. See the difference. I hope you do. Incidentally, the player which did the best job is the cheapest one of the three. It might tell you something when you want to go buying. To carry this on, and there are more examples, but as we all know, time is pressing us on. We place two similar obstructions all the way across. It's the white line up and down, which obstructed a little over 1% of the surface. The first player did a very good, admirable job. It still tracked, it still made the error correction, it still kept playing. The second started jumping some, the third just went totally bananas. Next we tried examining an obstruction, and can you see it here, the little white piece way up into the top? An obstruction going with the grooves, rather than perpendicular, which is what we had here. This represents an area only 1/10 the size of example one, just 0.05% of the playing surface. The audio examples which you would hear show clearly that even the best one, or the first one, does not track at all. It completely just skips all over it. From these examples, it's apparent that marks along the path of the recording signal will give much more trouble than those perpendicular to the path, something that's very reasonable and logical if you've thought about it at all. Therefore, any cleaning of compact discs should be accomplished with strokes from the center hole to the rim, not in the circular motion which we would normally use with a standard 78 or LP or 45 disc. An additional conclusion would be that not all compact disc players are created equal. Indeed, it might be a good idea to invest in a compact disc, obstruct it. This is a closer up of it. Obstruct it in some manner when you go out shopping for a CD player, if you're shopping for one. The salesman might not like you too much, but at least you'd have a pretty good idea that you got the one with the best error correction rate in it. By the way, in answer to your question, Lloyd, Bob wanted to see if that disc, which he had cut in half, would still play. He loaded it in, believe it or not, turned on the machine, and the player actually powered up and started spinning, but it immediately cut off once he got to the end to it. Thank you very much.